Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why candidates say yes or no to debating, and we talk progressive patriotism and how some on the left are trying to take back the flag. But first, the eligibility of 100,000 Arizona voters is up in the air this morning because of a flaw in the state's voter registration system that was just discovered, and time is running out before ballots are set to be mailed out. It was Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer's office that found the glitch, which shows that close to one out of every 45 registered voters in the state have not provided the required proof of citizenship needed to vote in local elections. Secretary of State Adrian Fontes said yesterday the problem applies to exactly 97,928 voters who got their driver's licenses before October 1st, 1996. That's the day when the state began requiring proof of legal presence in the country to get a license here. He admitted it's all adding fuel to the election conspiracy fire just weeks before a major election.
We're attacking the problem and making sure that folks can continue to be confident that those of us who are running Arizona's elections, we're going to face these controversies. We're going to face these issues, as uncomfortable as that may be for us.
Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services has been covering it all and joins us now to talk more about it. Good morning there, Howie.
Good morning. Well, grab a cup of coffee because this is complex, folks.
It definitely is. So let's start with the flaw that Richer's office found here in the state voter registration system. What went wrong?
Well, what went wrong goes back to a 1996 law that Governor Jan Brewer signed. And it said, if you want to get a driver's license in Arizona, you have to prove you're legally here. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean citizenship, but that was the basis. No problem with that by itself. 2004, voters approved a measure that says you have to provide proof of citizenship in order to cast a ballot in state and local elections. Now, remember, federal elections are governed by separate law, and you can just sign an affidavit. Mm-hmm. Now, what the 2004 law said was, if you have one of these new licenses post-96, we're going to assume that that's proof of citizenship. Again, no problem there. Now, again, if you are already registered and you've stayed registered, no problem there. Where it comes up is, let's say you come in 2006 and want to register to vote or want to change your registration. You move to a different county or something mm-hmm. like that. The county officials will go ahead and they will query the MVD database and say, do you have one of those post-1996 licenses? If you do, everything's fine. You know, you're presumed to be a citizen. If you have a pre-96 license, and again, because you're re-registering, you need to provide proof of citizenship, then you have to go in and find the documentation. What happened with the MVD database is somebody would come in, they may have had a pre-96 license, mm-hmm. but they went in and they got a duplicate license or they changed their address. MVD marked the license as being new on the date they changed their address. So when the county inquired, they said, okay, Howie Fisher has a 2006 license. No problem, even though all I did was change my address, never provided documented proof of citizenship. And now the question is, what happened to those people? Because as you point out, when they did a check on one of them, they found out that there were close to 100,000 folks right. who fell into this category and therefore do not have documented proof of citizenship, which raises the question, which goes to the lawsuits that are being filed, of do they get to vote come November 5th? On state and local elections.
Right. Okay. So this doesn't necessarily mean that these 100,000 voters, which is a whole lot of voters, we should say, by the way, won't be able to vote come November. It means whether or not they'll be able to vote in state and local elections or on this so-called federal-only ballot, right? And that's the issue in court right now.
That's exactly the issue in court. So what's happened is they filed what they call a friendly lawsuit. So each side knew who was filing. Stephen Richer filed his first documents yesterday. He said, look, if I do not have documented proof of citizenship, the only ballot I'm going to give to these 100,000 people is a federal-only ballot. You can vote for Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump. You can vote for the candidates for the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. You can vote for your local congressman. But you cannot, in the way I look at it, go ahead and vote for any state and local offices. You can't vote for or against propositions. What's happening today is the Secretary of State, who's Adrian Fontes, wants the court to take a position of, we don't have any evidence that they're not citizens. They've been voting all along. And it's just way too close to the election to cause this kind of chaos. So at least for this year, we should assume that they have the citizenship proof and give them a full ballot. And it'll be up to the Supreme Court to decide, you know, which is the case. You know, if you have one, if you fall in this 100,000 category, do you get to vote only in federal offices or do you get to vote on everything else?
Mm-hmm. This timeline is a big issue here, right? How fast can the state Supreme Court move to make this kind of call? They're getting ready to mail out ballots pretty soon here.
Well, how fast they can move and how fast they will move, that's another question. As you point out, the first ballots are what they call the UOCAVA ballots. Essentially, it's for folks who are overseas, military people living overseas. Right. They're supposed to go out this Friday. And so there's not a lot of time there. The next batch of ballots are the early ballots, which get mailed on October the 7th, I believe. And they want to have those ready to go to say, which of the ballots are we sending these people? Now, theoretically speaking, if the Supreme Court has the issue before them and nothing gets complicated, they could decide this by Thursday, maybe Friday, again, in enough time to do that.
Okay. Tell us who's affected here, more about this group of 100,000 voters. I mean, is it Democrats? Is it Republicans? Do we know where they're from? Howie, you were there? Seems like we may have lost the connection with Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. We'll move on now to the next segment and return to that conversation if we can get him back on the line. The country watched last week as former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris debated in a high-stakes moment in an already roller coaster of an election. But there are also a host of other local debates happening in Arizona right now that are meant to give voters a sense of the candidates, the issues, and where they stand. But not all of the candidates participate in these debates, and who does and who doesn't can say a lot about a race. Here to talk more about local debates and where they stand today is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky, joining us from our politics desk. Good morning there, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so these debates are supposed to be kind of a public service, right? They're run by the Arizona Clean Elections Commission. You are hosting a bunch of them, I know, this year. And some candidates are actually required to participate, right?
Yeah, so Clean Elections candidates, these are ones receiving public funding via the Clean Elections Commission. A part of that deal is that they have to show up to these debates and either participate in a Q&A if no one else shows up or debate against their opponents.
Okay. But for everyone else, it's optional. And if you kind of look at the Clean Elections website where they list all of these debates, it sure does look like there are a lot of candidates with kind of an X next to their name or that just didn't respond. Is it more than it used to be who sort of are opting out of these debates?
Well, I think speaking just since the past few election cycles since I've been participating, it's kind of always been like this at the legislative level and the congressional level, at least. I think there's a host of reasons why. But yeah, a lot of these candidates, both Democrats and Republicans, are choosing just to kind of skip these altogether.
Okay. All right. And it seems to be across the aisle, right? Like, this is not just Republicans, not just Democrats who are saying no thanks to debating. Talk a little bit about the politics here, Wayne. Like, what are the calculations that go into why a candidate would not or would want to debate?
Yeah. So to drive this home a little bit, I looked at all those, that list of all the debates that you looked about. And of the legislative debates that have happened so far, of the 16, 13 had someone, at least one candidate, not participating. And that includes Democrats and Republicans, like you mentioned. And I think a lot of the calculus here is that most of our legislative districts are not competitive. So they either lean so heavily towards one party or the other that we know who's going to win based on the letter next to their name. And so what you see is a lot of these safe incumbents, these already existing lawmakers, Democrats in heavily Democratic districts, Republicans in heavily Republican districts, aren't participating because they just, I don't think, see a benefit to it. I'm debating an opponent I'm going to defeat anyway. Why even show up?
That's so interesting because on its, it makes sense politically, but on its surface, like, does it serve the public?
Well, I mean, from a viewpoint that voters should be able to hear from the people that want to represent them, I would say no. I mean, even if you're going to handedly defeat this person, show up, spend half an hour, however long, describing your viewpoints and why you should be the person rather than just kind of accepting that you've been appointed based on your party registration.
Interesting. What about when a race is kind of too competitive, Wayne? Like when there's too much to lose for a candidate? Like I'm thinking of 2022 when we saw now Governor Katie Hobbs say, you know, I'm not going to debate Carrie Lake. Did that pay off for her?
It paid off for her, but I do think there's a real risk there because there's a situation where you need to define yourself and you're in a competitive district. So you're not guaranteed a win in this situation. Katie Hobbs has made the decision that debating against Carrie Lake, who was a very seasoned, you know, person in front of a camera based on her career as a broadcaster, and Katie Hobbs is a little bit more of a reserve speaker, and there was the whole issue of election denialism and spreading false rumors, and Katie Hobbs' team made the decision, and it worked out for them that, you know, if we do this, we can only hurt ourselves here. Mm. But I think there's a real risk when you're running in a competitive competitive district not debating, and I'm looking at the Maricopa County Recorder's race, where we have two candidates who no one really knows. We have Tim Stringham, the Democrat, and Justin Heap, a first-term Republican lawmaker. On the Republican side, Heap skipped both debates, a PBS debate and a clean elections debate, and he risks letting Stringham introduce himself to voters and voters not really knowing much about who he is, letting Stringham define him.
That's really interesting. So have you hosted debates this time around, Wayne, where, you know, it was just one side, essentially?
Yes, most of the debates I have hosted.
Wow.
Unfortunately, I host legislative debates, so online, so various legislative districts around the state, and I hosted one for Legislative District 22 on the west side, which is a heavily Democratic district, and all of the incumbents and Democrats running, including Minority Leader Lupe Contreras, who leads the Democrats in the House of Representatives, just didn't show up. So I was left talking to three Republican candidates who really have virtually no shot at winning, and I was happy to do it, happy to give them the venue to say why, hey, Democrats, independents, and Republicans should vote for them. But ultimately, I think it's a disservice to voters that they weren't able to hear from the people who are probably going to win that election.
That's really interesting. This continues to be an interesting case for Carrie Lake this time around, right? Because this election cycle, when she's running for Senate now, she didn't want to debate Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lim in the primary, right? When she was ahead and pretty sure she was going to win that primary. Now she's in a tougher race against Congressman Ruben Gallego on the Democratic side. And she really wants to debate, it sounds like. And there's also an added layer here where she's trying to get the Green Party candidate included in that debate as well.
Yeah, it all goes back to politics. It's interesting. Lake really eviscerated Hobbs for not debating her back in 2022, and now she chose not to debate her primary opponent. But it goes back to that safe district argument, right? Lake was always the favorite in that race, and I think she thought there's nothing I can do but hurt myself by giving Mark Lamb an opportunity to say why he thinks he's the better choice than me in a large venue. But now we're in a competitive race, and so Lake, rather, it's difficult to appeal to the independents and moderates who are probably going to decide that race if you're just kind of in your silos showing up to rallies where you're rallying your base and saying all the things that Lake has been kind of criticized for alienating those moderates she needs. In a debate, she can kind of go head-to-head with Gallego, try and define him as being too far left and show why she's the right choice for those moderates, and Gallego has the same opportunity. Mm-hmm. She wants that Green Party candidate in there because I think there's a calculated decision that they believe you'd pull more from the Democratic candidate versus the Republican.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a question about the format of debates, the kind of viewership of debates these days. I wonder, at a local level, like, do you think they matter to voters, or at least in the coverage that might come out of them could matter to voters?
It's a really difficult question to answer. I know that most of my debates legislatively that I'm doing, you know, they're streamed online. I can see how many viewers we have during the debate. In a lot of cases, it's not that many. But then they're archived on YouTube. And so I can definitely see a situation where once people get their ballots and they're like, oh, who's this person? Who should I vote for in this race that I haven't been paying attention to? Because unfortunately, down ballot races, legislative races, just have a lot less attention on them. You know, Googling the person's name, the debate comes up, and now they have a venue to see that. So I still think it's a valuable resource.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's just a question of how we bump up that viewership, how we let people know these things are happening, all that kind of thing to get voters more engaged with this process. Because I think if voter engagement, voter viewership went up, then you'd probably start seeing more people participate.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. All right. That is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, an author examines J.D. Vance's portrayal of poverty in his best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy.
Vance keeps telling us that the people who don't make it out aren't trying hard enough is soothing because poverty is made into a form of immorality in American culture.
A critique of Vance's view of the American dream. But first, for a long time in American politics, it seemed that the right had a claim to patriotism. From the symbols of patriotism, flying the flag or sporting a God Bless America bumper sticker, to the actual data. A Gallup poll from earlier this summer showed nearly 60% of Republicans said they were extremely proud to be American. Only 34% of Democrats were, but that's up from the record low of 2019, when just 22% of Democrats called themselves extremely proud of their country. But that all looked very different earlier this summer in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention.
Freedom, opportunity, compassion, dignity, fairness, and endless possibilities.
I've learned something about the Democratic Party, and I want to let my fellow Republicans in on the secret. The Democrats are as patriotic as us.
I want everybody in here to let us all say it together. I believe in America. Let me hear you. I believe in America.
It all culminated in Arizona Congressman Ruben Gallego bringing up a crowd of Democratic politicians who have served in the military to be recognized. Kamala Harris and Tim Walz's campaign has centralized patriotism, painting their stories as the kind that can only happen in America, and as the New York Times pointed out, celebrating our country and all that it stands for. It's a stark change from what we've seen on the left in recent years, but according to our next guest, it's an important one. Sam Richard is a Democratic consultant with Consilium Consulting here in Arizona, and he told me while he agrees the right seems to have a hold on at least the outward signs of patriotism, he sees it as more complicated than that. Here is our conversation in today's deep dive.
Without question, I think from a symbolic standpoint, from that surface level, I think there's clear ownership, at least from a perception, that the right has, you know, kind of a first position when it comes to what we understand as patriotism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I want to talk about what that looks like and what might be causing that on the left. Like, in the circles that you run in and in the Democratic politics world here in Arizona, do you hear a lot of complaints about, you know, about right now it's the war in Gaza, right? Or if it's climate change, or if it's, you know, sort of this idea of an imperialistic America and all over the world? Where do you think it stems from?
I think for me, you know, as a Democrat and as someone who, you know, lives by progressive values, the underlying intent of progress is that you need to see where there are opportunities for improvement. Mm. And I think that that's something that doesn't always align with people's understanding of patriotism, right? And there's a difference between blind faith in something and really wanting to make it better every day. I'm proud of my children, but that doesn't mean that, you know, I don't tell them where they can improve and be better tomorrow. And I think for me and the folks that I associate with as Democrats, that's what we want to do. There are opportunities for improvement in America's posture towards the Gaza and Israel conflict. I think that maybe how those conversations are talked about, whether it's performative outrage or actual honest conversations around policy differences, I think maybe be where some of the other consternation might come from. But mm-hmm. inherently, for me, that is what being a progressive is about, is trying to move forward with an understanding of where we've been. And you don't do that without being honestly critical and kind of making some, you know, courageous truth-telling central to the conversation.
I think that's really interesting. Is there a loss in that, or at least a risk maybe politically, which is, you know, your business here, right? Like, as you look at something like the way that maybe people in the middle look at the left, maybe not just the Democratic Party, but that all gets looped in, right?
Yeah.
Do you think there's a risk in kind of seeding patriotism?
Yes, it is a risky endeavor, because whether or not you're talking about people watching all 90 minutes of a presidential debate or caring about a policy at an intricate or complex level, the easiest answer usually wins. And I think that, you know, as a progressive, as a Democrat, it's hard to compete with less government, fewer taxes. That's, you know, that's a pretty well understood kind of rallying cry. And in the same respect, patriotism is the same way, right? Like, we should all support our flag. We should all support, you know, 4th of July parades and things like that. But I think that, in my view, kneeling during the national anthem is a very powerful statement to make on really important topics. Hmm. And it is a tool in a toolbox that says, hey, look over here, because we're not currently looking over here. And I still love this country and I want to be a part of this country, but there are some pieces of it that I feel needs improvement. And a way to do that is to call it out by doing something like burning the flag or kneeling during the national anthem. I think that's where it's easy to paint someone who might be doing that as unpatriotic. But in my view, that is the opposite of the truth.
Now we're seeing a really interesting moment in this, right? Because now we have a Democratic candidate for president, Kamala Harris, who is really embracing patriotism in a way that I don't know if we've seen of late. Watching the DNC was interesting, right? Because there were flags everywhere and chants of USA, USA. And she's, you know, trying to claim this idea of freedom and of American values and sort of her own quintessential American upbringing. What do you make of that? Like, coming from this sort of critical patriotic position that you've described here.
Yeah, I think that the Harris-Walz campaign has a unique opportunity right now to capture this moment, because to our earlier conversation, we were talking about the symbolic or kind of the natural ways that patriotism comes through. And for many people, that is law enforcement and military service. Mm-hmm. So you have someone who served as the attorney general for the nation's largest state, alongside someone who's running for vice president who spent years in the National Guard. If you juxtapose that with their alternatives, you have someone who served essentially a third of that time in the military from the vice presidency. And then the person running for president opted out of the draft for Vietnam by making up an excuse around bone spurs. So there is an opportunity and a moment to capture a redefinition of partisan alignment with patriotism and what true patriotism is.
All right, and we'll get to more of this in just a moment. That is Sam Richard, President of Government Affairs for Consilium Consulting. More of our deep dive conversation on progressive patriotism after the break. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. And let's return now to our deep dive conversation about progressive patriotism. I'm joined by Sam Richard, Democratic consultant for Consilium Consulting. I want to ask you about immigration as well, because I think that it's such a huge topic on the campaign trail right now for everybody here in Arizona and nationally. But also, it's an interesting moment in the debate over patriotism, right? Because lots of people will say immigration is the most patriotic thing you can do, right? Like, come to this country and want to be here. But also, you've seen Harris shift her position on immigration quite a bit, and now is talking very tough about the border. How do you think that plays in?
Again, I think that there are complexities to patriotism, which I think is maybe a theme of some of my answers here. And I feel like one of the things that we're seeing with the conversation around immigration is this separation from immigration policy and border security. Mm. And I believe that the Harris-Walz campaign has done a highly effective job at separating the two and talking about how welcoming immigrants is something that is a bedrock and foundational piece of who America is. At the same time, we need borders to define what America is. So I think separating who is America from what is America is something that will define the future of immigration policy conversations for a long time to come. And I think that that is where the dialogue has shifted. And I think that aligns with most voters. I mean, I think to bring it to Arizona, what now is known as Proposition 314 and was previously HCR 2060, the legislature, the Republican-led legislature attempted to separate border security from immigration policy. And you're seeing this play out in polling where that might be the top vote-getting initiative at the ballot this year, which we are the state, we are the home of the crisis around SB 1070. Mm-hmm. So to have that as bookends for the last 15 to 20 years has been an incredible journey to watch.
Tell us about your own political journey when it comes to patriotism, Sam. Like, would you call yourself a patriot?
Absolutely. I wouldn't necessarily put it on the first line of my LinkedIn bio, but I do think that that's where I align. And I think that what's interesting from a full circle perspective is that military service is something that's been very important to my family. Both of my grandfathers served, so that has always been there. But I've also been a lifelong Democrat. My parents are members of their local union at the school district that they serve in. So I think that the connection between patriotism and Democratic politics has never been one that has phased me as an individual. I'm very, very proud of this country. I'm also not shy about highlighting where and how and what we can do better. And for me, one of my first and dear mentors said that America would not be America without the dissent and discourse that highlights how we can do better tomorrow.
Yeah.
And for me, that's patriotism.
Have there been times, though, when you've been really mad at America?
Absolutely. I think maybe more so domestically than internationally, because there are things that I understand more clearly. But for a nation that is as wealthy as ours, you know, at a kind of a high level, it pains me to see the poverty and what I see because of the work that I do, the clear lines between policy changes and economic equity that we could achieve. And I think that there will always be opportunities that make me proud to be an American, as well as instances and scenarios in which I would be much prouder if we did things differently.
That's interesting. So I want to ask you about this because we talked about immigration, right? And I always think about this when I'm thinking about patriotism on the left. I have a friend who is probably one of the more liberal people who I know. And he agrees with, you know, a lot of the issues that you're talking about here, would totally agree with that and be critical of those things in this country. But he's also an immigrant. He came from Croatia. And I've seen him get mad at people who sort of trash America too much and say, like, this is, you know, these are all the problems and we are the worst and we should be doing things differently, because he has this very different perspective on that. I wonder if you've thought about that, or you know people like that, if that's a narrative in your life.
Absolutely, Lauren. For me, I think that one of the things that is at issue here is that if you don't have that personal experience, it's really hard to fully empathize with someone else's experience. And because America is exceptional, and because America is so great, we are lucky enough that likely 98% of people here have never had to have those very, very painful experiences in Croatia or Afghanistan, or people who, you know, are refugees to America from their homeland because of that pain. Mm-hmm. There are very few American refugees that go other places because America is unique and exceptional. And you have that bias of the experience that you had. So coming into a conversation where you're like, here's what I could do to make it better. You know, someone's like, we are already 3 decades better just because I showed up compared to where I came from. So it's difficult. It's complex. And I think that is what we're scratching at.
Maybe it says something about America that immigrants are the most patriotic among us sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in the same way that I think that everyone should work in customer service or restaurant world, I think that every American citizen should spend at least a month of their lives every decade in another country just to, you know, appreciate what's different and appreciate what we hold dear here in America.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Sam Richard, President of Government Affairs for Consilium Consulting, joining us. Sam, thank you so much for coming in to talk about
this.
I appreciate it.
Great to be here, Lauren. Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Crime and crime rates are often topics of conversation around elections, and this year is no different. FBI data show violent crime is down, but those and other numbers are often incomplete. It's impossible, for example, to know how many crimes are committed and not reported. Earlier this year, my co-host Mark Brody spoke about this with Bradley Bartos, a professor in the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. He's trained in criminology and says crime as we know it is evolving. When they spoke, he asked Bartos what stands out to him about the data.
Well, that involves a few simultaneous big picture changes. All of this began our modern kind of sensibility towards the recent rise in crime happened during the pandemic, 2020 through 2022. And now we're seeing preliminary results from the FBI's Uniform Crime Report quarterly estimates that we're seeing some large decreases. And this has been backed up by various third-party data sources that have looked at city police departments and data, public data portals, and collecting those into a multi-city kind of canary for the nation, more or less giving a sense of where crime is going in a faster, potentially more reactive manner.
I'm curious about that because, like, was there something about the pandemic era that fundamentally changed crime, I guess, for lack of a better word, or maybe the kinds of crimes that were being committed or the ways in which they were being committed?
Well, that's really, I think it helps to talk about why crime happens at all, to answer that question, right? Like, why does crime occur? Two theories that I think are particularly relevant to our COVID era changes, a change to our routine activities. So routine activities theory states that crime will occur if three conditions are met. There's an attractive target, a motivated offender, and the absence of a capable guardian. You get all three of those things, then crime will occur. If any one of them is missing, it will not. So in that framework, our routines, where we were, how we behaved, what we did throughout the day changed pretty drastically once work from home, school closures, and even the more or less restaurant and retail spaces we previously inhabited. Instead, we were more or less in our homes, mm-hmm. online shopping more than ever before. Those changes are as temporary as the changes to our routines. So as kids are more reliably at school, fewer closures for COVID and for other various interruptions to the supervision of kids. As those kind of go away, we might see us return to a pre-pandemic normal. Now, the other theory, you know, why does crime occur, that I wanted to talk about is strain theory. Basically, the mismatch between your needs and the legitimate means you have to satisfy your needs.
So I'm wondering, you know, when you talk about changing routines during COVID and, you know, some of the stressors that people were under, could that have led, for example, to the increase in motor vehicle thefts? If people weren't leaving their homes as much and the cars were maybe sitting in a driveway or sitting on the street parked somewhere, does that help in any way?
You are 100% correct. And in fact, not only are by not commuting to and from work and not using our cars, you know, and as many times throughout the day, if even one time per day on average, means that we are not guarding our vehicles. You know, those three things that have to happen for a crime to occur, you know, attractive target, motivated offender. Well, who guards your car from a car theft? Somebody being in it, around it, to watch it and, yeah. you know, more or less identify the person who is stealing the car. Now, take that logic to another piece of high-value property that we were guarding more closely than ever before, our homes.
Right.
So residential burglary, big reductions in each year since the pandemic. So between 2019 and 2020, there's a 21% reduction in residential burglary, and that stayed stable between 20 and 26% over the next 4 years. So as we spend less time in our cars, more time at home, our cars are more vulnerable, our homes are less so.
So I'm curious how the online world has changed all of this, both in terms of different types of cybercrime, but also the ability to track different kinds of crime, and maybe even the ability to publicize different kinds of crime on online sites or social media, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason why these large group shoplifting events are so powerful tools in making public and each of us feel like property is less safe right now than it was in the past. And a large part of that is due to how many cell phone videos, CCTV cameras that are actually recording to digital hard drives. Having these videos makes egregious crime events really powerful in our memories and really influential in how much we fear crime. Now, if fewer people are being victimized, but we're all vicariously seeing victims through these videos, we might get a really biased sense of what's actually going on the ground. Now, we have taken a lot of our activity, not just since 2020, but since the 80s, the mid-80s, we have slowly relegated certain activities we used to have to go into public. We slowly and steadily relegated many of those things to digital commerce and communication. So criminologists love to look at the rise in crime and the great American crime drop that happened through the 70s to the early 90s, all the way through about 2016. There was just year after year falling violent and property crime. And again, it's this, how many simultaneous things do we have to disentangle to get a picture of it? But in a routine activities framework, we simply were exposing ourselves to fewer robberies. We are exposing our houses to fewer burglaries. The opportunities that we have, or the risks that we face for victimization and the risks our property face, have been reduced pretty heavily by the amount of distance we put between each other through the internet.
Bradley Bartos is a professor in the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. Ever since former President Donald Trump selected Ohio Senator J.D. Vance as his running mate, there's been renewed interest in Vance's best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. The book was released to wide acclaim in 2016, with many journalists praising it for what seemed to them like an honest accounting of what it's like to experience poverty in rural and Rust Belt parts of the country. The book was later adapted into an Oscar-nominated film. Since Vance's nomination for vice president, he's leaned into the reputation he's gained from the book as an ambassador for downtrodden Americans in those regions. But Alyssa Court isn't so sure Vance is a reliable narrator. Court is the author of Bootstrapped: Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream, a book that frames poverty as a systemic inequality issue rather than a personal crisis that can be overcome through sheer grit and gumption. And as Court told the show's Sam Dingman, the most telling scene in Hillbilly Elegy is the one where Vance gets invited to a fancy law school dinner and panics because he doesn't know which fork to use.
Because it was kind of a class anxiety. He's worrying about being judged by his fellow students, and he's up against what he doesn't know about upper middle class and upper class manners. And he wants it both ways. He'll say things like, "Poor people are my people." He said that in an interview. But then he has all this contempt. So he says things about people who are, you know, from the holler. You have to stop making excuses and take responsibility. And that is the mark of somebody who is all about where he's going rather than where he's been.
Yeah. Well, and it assumes that anybody who lives in a place like the one that he decided to leave wants the same things as him rather than to stay. And one of the things that you write about in the piece I read of yours on LitHub is that there are a great many writers about the Rust Belt and Appalachia and the working class more broadly who are doing so from those places, and that their writing about the experience of living in environments like that is very different than J.D. Vance's. So tell us what you see as the differences between the kind of writing that emerges from those places than writing like Vance's, which sort of looks back in anger, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, I divide it into two categories. One is the working class traitor, mm-hmm. which is very much the Vance thing. And the other kind is the class defector. And those are people who leave their working class backgrounds. I'm thinking of a book like Milltown by Carrie Arsenal. These kind of books, the class defector changes their life and lives and goes to these, you know, nice colleges and becomes a literary figure. But there's a lot of kind of love for where they came from, and also a critical perspective on the equivalent of the Ivy League that they wind up in. And I think that's one of the things that's strange to me about J.D. Vance's version of the world, that he doesn't seem to understand systemic poverty at all. So he doesn't have any forgiveness for the people that he lived amongst. But he also doesn't have any critical vision of the Peter Thiels, this wealthy Silicon Valley billionaire who's libertarian, that he is his mentor. But those people are blameless. And there's a long tradition behind this. I mean, so like a lot of the classics of American literature had this ideology. And in my book, I talk a lot about the lies that are underneath it, the ways in which all these different people actually received help, including J.D. Vance.
Yes. Well, one of the places that J.D. Vance got help from is the press. And as you write in this way, quote, "Vance is our monster." So tell me a little bit about what you mean by that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Vance's story flatters in a certain way liberal critics. It soothes class privilege liberals, because you read it and you think, you know, this is a rags to riches story. There's authenticity and realness. A lot of, you know, at this point, something like 73% of our journalists and critics are on the coasts. And that's the majority. And so they are open to this kind of fetishistic version of real American poverty that's something out of the 1970s film Deliverance. And the fact that, you know, Vance keeps telling us that the people who don't make it out aren't trying hard enough is soothing, because poverty is made into a form of immorality in American culture. And I think there is a problem with the press, that we have a press that's so privileged in a certain way, educationally privileged in particular, that they don't really understand what this world's like. So they're willing to sort of buy into these accounts.
Yeah.
Another funny phrase, somebody used pornography to describe the kind of thing J.D. Vance, right?
Well, one of the things that makes me think about is, and tell me if you agree, when Hillbilly Elegy came out, much of the coverage from what you have called the progressive culture makers, who were kind of like reviewing and elevating this book, is that there was such a rush at the time amongst mainstream media outlets to understand, like, but who are these Trump voter people?
Yes.
Like, how could this have happened? And that much of the evaluation of Hillbilly Elegy, it seemed to me, was about making themselves feel better for now knowing who those people were, according to J.D. Vance, rather than making an effort to actually understand their perspective via a messenger other than somebody who, as you were pointing out, seems to have a good bit of contempt for that world and, in fact, left it far behind.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a cartoonish version, right? Mm-hmm. And that's comforting unto itself. You know, you don't really have to get to know it. I mean, one thing that I was thinking, though, is that I do think that there is a degree of trauma in J.D. Vance's account of where he's from. Like, he did have a hard time, seemingly. And
of course,
he had to separate himself from it.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, you know, we are talking about a victim of pretty severe abuse.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's irresponsible to use the word trauma to describe the environment that he grew up in. I mean, he was physically abused and psychologically abused by somebody who clearly was dealing with their own demons in the form of his mom.
And I don't mean to get into his head like a, you know, armchair psychiatrist, but it's a kind of human self-protective impulse, I think, to protect, you know, the dry land that you're on. Mm-hmm. And then you can sort of point fingers at people who are more vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, as a note to close on, one of my favorite parts of, again, that interview with you that I read is you said, quote, "It's really too bad that Hillbilly Elegy wasn't turned into something like Adaptation. Could you imagine if there was a meta version? How much better would it be if Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman made a version of Hillbilly Elegy?" And I could not help wondering how far you have taken that fantasy in your mind.
Yeah, well, so this is the thing. Ron Howard, right, the, from Happy Days, like the most all-American filmmaker, right, makes the movie version of Hillbilly Elegy, which was a total flop. And it cast, like, you know, Glenn Close, like all these incredible A-list actors. But it was taken totally straight, and these actors left their Tribeca and, you know, West Side LA apartments to put on a wig and pretend to be Meemaw, right? Mm-hmm. But I was like, what if they had a desperate screenwriter trying to imagine himself into Ohio and into Kentucky? Like, in a way, that would be more accurate. That would be verite. That would be like the honest to God. That was what, you know, Ron Howard leaving his, you know, meeting with a cappuccino, trying to figure out how to do a movie about Appalachia. So anyway, that is my fantasy.
Okay. I really hope that happens. Alyssa Quart is the author of Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Alyssa, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.